You hear in the press people remarking, why would an innocent person ever plead guilty? But the individual stories talk of a much more pragmatic approach to life.
Yeah.
But they could wind up in this mess by voluntarily telling the court system they're guilty of a crime or not.
Yeah.
How is that addressed?
Yeah. I think part of what we have to do in order to make the plea bargain system actually work, because the plea bargain system has to be a part of the process. You can't just say no one can plea to the accusations. But you have to have a couple of things, I think, that will make that plea actually real and effective. You have to have good court-appointed counsel, right? So the idea that an individual who's confronting with a jail sentence, and this was an ACLU case, the right to a court-appointed attorney if you can't afford one. Gideon versus Wainwright, that was our case many years ago. And that was a Supreme Court decision that's been enshrined in the law books, but not enshrined in reality in many local jurisdictions. And the way it's worked is that we let state by state, often sometimes county by county, determine the process by which they will provide a court-appointed attorney if you can't afford one. And that means in some places you don't have access to a court-appointed attorney, either who's competent or until it's way too late. We have a case, a lawsuit right now, John, that in New Orleans, where we were invited by the New Orleans Public Defender's Office to sue them because they said, we can't do our job. The caseloads are too high. We're inadequately resourced. There are too many pressures put on us, and we cannot provide our clients proper advice in this process. And so I think an important part of how we have to fix that is by providing for greater resources for truly making good on that promise. If you're too poor and are facing jail time and can't afford a lawyer, one will be appointed for you, that a good counsel will be appointed to you. The second one, the second problem that often gets people is money bail. Now, bail was never meant to be kind of a punitive fine, right? So when I speed, not very often, but when I speed and I'm a little bit higher than the speed limit and I get a ticket in a place like East Hampton, I pay it. It's a fine. You know, it's like, yes, I should have been going 35 and not 40. Thank you, officer. Have a nice day. But often when people are charged with minor offenses and they come up before a judge, the judge will automatically impose bail no matter what. And for poor people, the inability to post bail because they lack the money or lack the assets that they could leverage to post that bail means they go back into jail until their case comes up. And much of what we've been trying to do is to demand the right to bail is an essential part of our constitutional rights. And if you're not able to pay that bail, the judge has got to kind of figure out the circumstances by which you can get either let out or determined about whether or not you can get let out on your own recognizance. And very often, bail was meant to be an impediment from the person fleeing the jurisdiction. But if you have kids in school and if you have a house and you have a job or you have a place where you live, those are factors that the judge can look at and say, look, I don't need to ask you for $5,000 bail because you were carrying marijuana. I can let you out on your own recognizance. And in fact, the research shows that people who are let out on their own recognizance do in fact come back to contest the charges and often are vindicated in the process. Now, but if you don't have access to a good lawyer and you don't have access to bail and you're sitting in that jail cell for 30, 40, 50, 60, 90, 120 days in some circumstances before you actually get to the heart of the matter, and the court-appointed attorney says, look, just plead to the lower offense. You know, just plead to a kind of plead guilty to a lower crime, and let's just get this done behind you. And you get out today, and you say, sure. You know, that's the worst that's going to be imposed upon me is already the time I've served in jail. The problem is that record follows you. And if you have a second infraction or another offense, and if you're not able to pay the court fees that are often imposed upon you when you leave, that then can also lead you back into jail. And so I think you're exactly right that there, that many people don't fully understand the whole posting bail and the whole access to lawyer, access to counsel component that leads folks to often agreeing to plead guilty to crimes they didn't even commit. And that's part of the problem we have to fix. Other questions, comments, please.
Would you talk a little bit about the profit motive in the correctional system?
Yeah.
Specifically, you know, the growth of private prisons in the United States.
It is truly one of the most pernicious and cynical developments. I don't know enough about the state of Montana, but I do know, like, for instance, in the state of Arizona, one out of every four jail beds is run and operated by a private prison corporation. Now, private prison corporations are corporations of shareholders who build and run facilities, turn a profit, that is, that they get more money through government contracts than they spend on the services, and then distribute that profit to both their corporate leaders and to shareholders. There are four ones that I'm aware of. The two large ones are the Correction Corporation of America and the GEO Group, publicly traded on the stock markets. You can pull up their prospectuses online. I encourage you to do so. It will give you a chuckle. The GEO Group in particular, they have holdings in foreign countries as well as America. And so they have these aerial shots of prisons in Britain, in South Africa, in Ireland, that look like Club Med destinations. And they talk about state-of-the-art health facilities, state-of-the-art recreation facilities. And our counterpart organizations in a place like South Africa is in fact suing the GEO Group for the abysmal conditions of one of their facilities just outside of Johannesburg. The profit motive is very simple. You have these corporations that say, we will take these prisons off of your hands, state governments, local officials, state governors. We will run them more efficiently for you, and we'll do so at to your benefit and at our profit. What you won't be clear about unless you do the research, and we've hired actually a series of private investigators and investigative reporters to dig into these corporations, which is part of the reason why we've begun to know so much about them. Part of what they do is that they hire lobbyists who often come from, who are either retired state legislators or retired law enforcement officials to then serve as their lobbyists to gain the government contracts. So they're hiring people right out of the government to go back and lobby the government for these government contracts. As part of the contracts, they will often require the state to guarantee a bed quota. That is, we will run your jails and prisons, but you will guarantee us, Mr. Governor, that the beds will be filled 30% within the first year and 80% within, you know, the third or fourth year. So they will require the state to fill the beds as a way for them to turn their profit. Now, that creates a perverse incentive on the cops to arrest and detain and fill the beds to make the quota. And it's truly astonishing when you think about the idea that individuals are making money off of our tax dollars, because there are our tax dollars who are now being given to these private corporations as government contracts as a way to deal with our public welfare system. Now, I think the greater scrutiny we can place upon them, you should certainly look at your mutual funds, your IRAs, your retirement funds. You can ask your TIA Creft or Fidelity or Schwab if any of your underlying funds have holdings in the CCA or the GEO Group. If they do, you can begin to ask them to, you can petition them. We have begun to petition our own investment holdings, our own pension plan. We've instructed our investment advisors to ensure that they withdraw any holdings in CCA and the GEO Group. If you want to keep your holdings and become an activist shareholder, we can help you. You know, the idea that you can show up at a shareholder meeting and really make trouble is really fantastic. We've done that in a couple of instances. I think we also have to be engaged in the process of naming and shaming the individuals who are both employed by and benefit from these private prison corporations. There is one individual who serves on the board, a paid board, corporate board seat of the Correction Corporation of America, whose name is Thurgood Marshall Jr. His father was the father. And Thurgood Marshall Jr. is a paid corporate board member at CCA. I know Thurgood. I've met him. I would sometimes consider him a friend. I think it's shameful, so I take the opportunity to shame. And I think we need to do that more and more openly, because ultimately the pressure has got to be placed on our governments to retract these contracts. The final thing I'll say that's very interesting, the states that haven't had the rise of private prison corporations have ironically been the states where you have strong prison guard unions. So in California, for instance, you don't have the flourishing of private prisons because the sheriffs and the prison guards and the warden unions are too strong and they've kept them out. So we've begun to find common ground. We are an equal opportunity foe and we are an equal opportunity ally. So we're actually working with the prison guard unions as an effort to try to shut down the private prison corporations. They're often some of the same people we fight against on the prison conditions and treatment of prisoners. But on this one, we can find common ground. And I do think it's something that is, I think for the students in the room, this is something you should ask your university about how much are they invested in the Correction Corporation of America or the GEO Group. Divesting from coal, divesting from fossil fuels, divesting from private prison corporations. It's not that much more to add onto the agenda. That you'll forgive me, Assistant Provost, but I think it's I want to make sure that there is good activism that we can do. Please, in the back. Okay.
The most clear message that I got.
Please tell me your name, please.
Dan Lurie.
Hi.
40-plus year ACLU.
Thank you very much.
Worked in both white and black poverty communities. The lesson for me from Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, which I presume you've read, many of your people have read, is the degree of despair that there ever would be or ever has been any measure of equality from the legal justice system and from the police system. And I wonder how or if the ACLU can address that, for me, a revelation, even after a long lifetime of considering those issues.
I think individuals like Ta-Nehisi Coates, whom I greatly admire and have known for a number of years, even before his most recent book, I think they play an important role as public intellectuals, as leaders of a public conscience, to talk very clearly about the problems, the challenges, the despair. And I think it's important that for white communities and for empowered communities and individual and communities that don't struggle the way that minority or low-income communities struggle, to hear that despair so you can contextualize the activism, at times the anger, at times the rhetoric. I think it's incredibly important to kind of paint the context of why you have people who are as vocal and as vigorous and sometimes as in your face as the Black Lives Matter movement, and why they have come out that way is not because they're angry people who just found each other. You know, that these are people who were made angry by the systemic violence and the indignity and the injustices they suffer day to day. I think it's an incredibly important contribution to help us understand the context. As an advocate, I don't find cynicism useful. There is nothing useful about cynicism. And I completely understand, appreciate, and acknowledge the fact that there is systemic racism in the police departments, that there's been impunity, that police officers have acted like this for decades, and nothing has happened for too long a time. But I cannot fall to the point of saying that it's always been like this and it will always be like this because of the kind of racism in our country, because ultimately that leads you not to a path of change or of reform. I actually think that some of the very same kind of depictions of this is intractable and this is, you know, this has always been part true is true. I mean, police brutality in minority communities has been around for a very, very long time. What's changed in this context has been the emergence of these devices that we all carry, where you can actually film a cop shooting a kid in the back with his hands up, and it's no longer having to take the word from the people who live across the tracks saying, you know, they shot him and he was innocent. Right, you always heard those statements. Now you don't have to say those statements. You just post the videos, and now you have Publix who are waking up and saying, "Wow, that's not right." And I think that alone has helped move the debate forward. I think that alone has helped demand a level of accountability that's just beginning to enter, I think, a level of maturation, which might come a very long way. I'm very proud of the work that the ACLU's done, both in courts. The thing we've done that I think is sometimes as innovative and not as well known is that one of the things we developed was this thing called the mobile justice app, right? So for free, I think through the iPhone store, it's not a commercial, you can download in different states this mobile justice app. And it walks you through what are your rights if the police should stop you. How do you assert your rights? Gives you tips on how to do it in a respectful manner so you don't get yourself clubbed by the police officers. It gives you some guidance. It also has a recording function. So it tells you if you wish to record this police interaction, press this button, and then it will record it. And then when you're done, it will send it in to the ACLU local office, right? So we've piloted this in about 17 different states. It's been downloaded tens and tens of thousands of times. One of the most recent clips that I got that I thought that was, I don't get them because I get a lot of things, but I don't get all these videos. Someone else gets these videos. But once in a while, they send me one. They say, I want you to check this out, Anthony. This will make your day. There was a police officer who was arresting a young African-American man in L.A., and one of his friends pulled out his phone and hit the mobile justice app and then said, hey, cop, you know, you're being filmed with the ACLU is going to get a copy of this video, right? And he just held it there. And the cop continues to put the cuffs on the guy and read him his rights. And in the middle of it, the police incident, he says, how am I doing so far? And he looks at the camera and smiles. Now, he might have done that anyway, but I think if there's a way to serve as a deterrent, I think the use of body cameras on police officers, you know, just like dashboard cameras served as a way to ensure that cops didn't beat people up when they pulled them over, I think the more transparency and accountability of law enforcement officials, I think we will ultimately push it to a point. I also don't think we've ever seen a broader public recognition of police brutality and the need for police accountability as we've seen over these last several years. It's just with the deaths of Eric Gardner, of Trayvon Martin, the kind of the eruption in Ferguson, there is a kind of a public, something qualitatively different about this debate around police abuse and brutality than the ones we saw in the 80s or 90s or 2000s. And so because this debate seems to be much more vigorous, much more youthful, often multiracial, I tend to be more optimistic than Ta-Nehisi Coates, although I very much admire him. How about other questions? Please, sir. I think they're going to get you a microphone. Thanks. What's your name?
My name is David Steinmuller. I'm also a very long-time ACLU member. Well,
thank you very much.
You mentioned prison guard brutality, and it's not uncommon to read about this in news media. And I imagine the average inmate doesn't have a recording device. Is this a subject that ACLU has looked into? Yeah. Varying standards, requirements, training, yeah. Racism.
So. Yeah. The prison guards often are some of the individuals who can make all the difference in the world of whether even a bad facility turns awful or whether a bad facility can get better. And so they're the frontline soldiers. And so even in an overcrowded system with poor resources and inadequate health care and overcrowding, if you have a good, well-trained prison guard cadre, they can make sure that it doesn't go from bad to worse. If you have a bunch of thugs as prison guards, it can make that sheer chaos. And so the very same L.A. County men's jail that I reference, it's just I could talk too long about that particular facility. There was a 60 Minutes documentary. If you actually Google L.A. County men's jail guard gangs, see what pops up. I think that's the way to look for it. There was a documentary that showed that the guards themselves at the LA County Men's Jail were organized into competing violent gangs with each other. Like the Bloods and Crips on the inside, you had guard gang one, guard gang two, guard gang three, and they would beat up on each other. And they would foment violence in each other's wards. And so you just say the entire ecosystem is a Superfund site. It's just got to be closed down. You got to scratch. You got to start from scratch. And I do think that one of the things we have to do is look closer at holding prison guards and prison wardens accountable. And I'll tell you one anecdote of another a client I've met over the years. Roderick Johnson was a young African-American man in Texas. He served, I think, in the Marines. Gay. And when he got out of the Marines, he met a boyfriend who was not good company for him. And he found himself committing three small misdemeanors in the state of Texas, right? So I think the last crime he committed, that he was serving as a golf caddy at a golf club, and he stole three golf balls. And that was his third misdemeanor, and three strikes, you're out in Texas. So he was sentenced for a felony conviction that had, I think, almost 2 years of jail time, and sentenced to, I want to say, the Elbert County facility, one of the worst facilities in Texas. Upon arrival at the facility, he tells the prison warden, I'm gay. What can you do to protect me? And the prison warden said, you need to find yourself a husband who will protect you, right? And threw him into the most violent ward in the whole facility. That same day, he was gang raped, sold from gang to gang, gang to gang, from the white skinheads to the black gang to the Chicano gang to the Nazis, violently raped by tens of inmates. His sister finally calls us and says, my brother's about to commit suicide. You've got to help him. And we get down there, and we are able to meet with him and then isolate him in a way that they should have put him in protective custody to begin with. And then we brought a series of, and the thing that was so, not to be, I don't think there are too many children in the room, not to be overly gruesome, but the thing that allowed us to bring this lawsuit against the guards and against the prison warden himself was because every time he was so brutally gang raped, he was brought to the infirmary, and there were rather detailed medical notes of the physical impact of those violent rapes in the prison health facility. So no one could say that didn't happen. We ultimately went and we sued. We actually were able to get some of the prisoners to point the finger at the guards who turned their back when they were raping him. There were some guards in the facility who watched, who observed the rapes and who let it happen. And since the prisoners actually don't like the guards, they were all too quick to point the finger at them. And then we were able to bring lawsuits against a number of the guards, including to the prison warden. And it was a trial for damages, right? We couldn't do anything else. He was already out at this time. We tried to sue them for intentional infliction of emotional distress and some of the harm caused to him. We lost that jury trial. We spent, I don't know, $600,000 bringing that case. And as part of any good jury trial case, you interview the jurors after they render your verdict against you. You try to learn, what did we do wrong? What could we have done differently? Why did we not win? And as we interviewed the jurors in Texas, they said, oh, we believed him. We believed the fact that he was raped. And we believed that the guards let him be raped. We just didn't want to award him any money. And that you walk away and say, huh. You know, we tried to pick as good a jury as we could, but sometimes juries in these very kind of racially polarized environments are never going to be places where African-American homosexual men who were victims of violence because they were criminals in a detention center, where I argue he should never have been there to begin with, are just not going to award the guy money because of his trouble. So I do think that, so we keep at it. Part of what we do, there was one other case where we actually won against a guard. It was very exciting. You put the fear of God in them. If you sue an individual guard for rape, the one we won was against a guard who was transporting women from a detention center and raping them in the transport truck when he was taking them to the court. We won. And we won. The man is broke. We got his pension plan. We got his house. We got everything, right? Too bad, in my mind. What it did do is that it put the fear of God in the other guards, where they're like, oh, no. I don't want to lose my pension plan or my home or all of my savings. And so you use it as a deterrent to ensure better behavior of what should never be allowed in the first place. Why don't we take one last question, if you have time, and then we'll wrap it up. Hi.
What kind of problems...
What is your name, sir?
My name is John Schellenberger. What kind of problems are there with the mainstream media in getting these stories out? What kind of problems do you encounter?
You know, I think the mainstream media is increasingly paying some attention to it. We work very hard to place these stories when we're able in the large outlets, in kind of the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR. There's often such a limited amount of space, and unless it's tied to something that is very specific, the newspapers prefer to pass over. There's been I'm not sure if you've seen it, but the New York Times has been really fantastic on covering the violence in Rikers Island, because it's the state penitentiary in New York, and they've done full page spreads. Often we've given them names of clients of ours, and they work with other groups. I actually think the two media organizations that are doing probably the best place, if you want to read news reports about criminal justice reform, it's this thing called the Marshall Project. It was created by a man, David Keller, who used to be the lead publisher of also the lead editor of the New York Times. He retired from the New York Times and then created this specific journalistic. It's only online. I don't think they publish in paper. It's a virtual journalistic organization that publishes only on criminal justice reform. So when I want to kind of understand what's happening in a given moment all across the country, you can sign up for their press announcements. I think they're really quite good, and they're really thorough. They're kind of a synthesis of often what else is out there, and they do some of their own research and writing. The other group that I think has done some really good investigative work is ProPublica, if you know that. That's the investigative research organization, also out of New York. And they have a number of people on staff who are both whose background is in criminal justice reform and who are trained in it. And so those are two outlets that I think have begun to kind of set the pace. You're right, we need to do much more of it. And part of your point, to close on this, part of the reason why I focus on this and telling the stories of individuals in jails and in prisons is when you think about the way that we have structured incarceration in America, it is done with our money, right? They tax us and we pay a lot of money in taxes that often should go to schools and roads and often end up in the wrong places, bombs and prisons, in my mind. But there are money. It's our money being spent on this. And yet there's some of the most opaque places where you can't really tell what's going on with your taxpayer dollars. You know, you have much better ways of knowing what's going on through the public schools because you have local school boards. You can go down to local schools. You can be involved in the schools if you're a teacher. You can be involved in the PTA. Those public institutions spending your tax dollars, they may not be perfect, but they're at least more transparent to you. Good luck with prison and jails, right? They are purposely out of sight, out of mind. We build these facilities sometimes very far away from urban centers so that the people don't have access to lawyers and don't have access to journalists. You don't know what goes on behind those walls by design. There's very little transparency on a major part of government operations. And part of what I think we need to do is we need to crack open these closed spaces that, unless they're open, the conditions are too ripe for abuse, and for abuse of power and for mistreatment of people. And the more that we can kind of shed the light into what our detention centers and jails look like, the more people will engage and say, well, that ain't right. And what can we do to fix that? And that's part of the reason why I think this is one of the top priorities for us at the ACLU, and I dare say a top issue for all of us. I thank you for your patience. I thank you for your questions. And thank you for your hospitality.